is the best album ever. The show on an obsessively unrelenting journey of discovery and illumination, culminating in the crowning of the most significant collected work of audio greatness in the history of recorded sound. I'm your host, Ben Helms, and today we continue our journey together in search of the best album ever. Today with my guest, we'll dive into their album of choice and cover everything from the writing, recording, and reception of said album, as well as some personal anecdotes that might even elevate the record into an echelon not previously known to humankind. My guest for that adventure today is none other than Dr. Jason Helms, brother by nature, friend by obligation, and proud member of the Overthink family. Jay, tell me real quick what you do for a living, and then maybe tell me about one or two of your other Overthink shows.
Sure. I teach at TCU. Do research on comic books, video games, web stuff, technology stuff, and my field is rhetoric. And then I run some extra podcasts. One is on how to read comics, and that lines up nicely with my research interests. And then one that's just completely for fun is called What Exactly Am I Watching Here? And I think it's got the best elevator pitch of any of our podcasts. In it, an expert and a novice both watch a TV show together. One that somebody has seen before, one that the other person has not seen, and the expert walks the novice through it. It's a blast. We just finished Twin Peaks' original run. We're getting ready to do the return.
Yeah, I think the finale of season two comes out later this week or next week. So yeah, it's just finishing now. And you're going to do the movie?
Yeah.
That's in between?
Yep.
That came out after? Yeah, I don't even know. I'm editing all of them. I've still never seen it.
But I love your process. The fact that you're editing these. You know who killed Laura Palmer, but you don't know who Laura Palmer is.
Yeah. I think I do.
And the answer is and that's not helpful.
Is that? Wait, did you really just ruin Twin Peaks for everyone listening?
You figured that out pretty quickly. It's more the question is more who is Bob? Wait, what's happening? Where's my mind?
All right, I might bleep that. We'll see.
Yeah,
but anyway,
go ahead and bleep it. It's fine.
Get back to the podcast that we're actually recording. So your album of choice when you told me it, which I actually think I suggested you,
yeah.
And you're like, oh yeah, that.
Yeah.
but it's very polarizing to a lot of music. It's in a lot of music lovers and critics, like top 10 albums of all time, and it's not in a lot of like top 100 lists as well.
Yep.
So it's just kind of all over the place. It's an album that I've definitely heard of. I knew the band really well. I knew a couple songs off the album, but I knew it more as like an influencer of bands and genres that I love, and less so like intimately aware of that. I mean, they only had two albums.
This band.
So yeah. So but we haven't spoiled it yet. But let me start with this. How did you kind of come to be aware of this album in the first place when it came out in the 90s? And kind of how did you come to appreciate it so much?
I'd never heard of this before. And so I'd say about 2007, I was in grad school, and my friend, I think this is who it was, James Roland, told me about it.
Oh.
James Roland hosts a podcast on the Overthink podcast network occasionally. And
The Close Up, check it out.
And I believe the pitch was just like, this is the greatest album of all time, go listen to it. And I was like, all right, whatever.
I love it.
And I tossed it on when I was taking my exams for my PhD. And I didn't listen to it at all. It was just on. And I found that for whatever reason, I could.
Wait, what do you mean you didn't listen to it, but it was on?
Well, I didn't pay any attention. I was writing.
Okay.
And so it was on. It was going into my ears, but I was paying zero attention to it.
Okay.
And then the music ran out, and I was, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 words in, and like I'd never written like that before. And I was like, well, I'm starting that album over again. And ever since, it has been the music that I write to. And so the band is Neutral Milk Hotel. The album is In the Aeroplane Over the Sea. And the reason it's the best album ever is because it can get you to create things that you didn't know you could create. And what's amazing to me is now I never paid attention to the lyrics. I had heard one time that the entire thing was a love letter to Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know what that means. And then I listened to some of the lyrics a little bit closer and I was like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. And then just didn't pay attention again. And it wasn't until it came to do this podcast that I was like, all right, I'm going to do a deep dive, find out about this album that I've literally listened to over 1,000 times. I'm pretty certain. Almost every word that I've ever written since those dissertation exams, anything that I've published, I have been listening to that album while I was writing it. And so, yeah, finally paid attention to the lyrics. And one of the really cool things is that I learned that that's actually the way the band feels, is their goal is just to get you individually to create something beautiful and unique. And that's why they made their music. And that's why it's such a weird album and such a polarizing album.
Yeah.
Because it's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird.
So just to give, if you have not listened to this album, you're only hearing snippets on this podcast, this might give you an idea of how weird, we're going to say that word a lot, how weird this album is. The list of instruments in the liner notes, obviously vocals and guitar. Sure. Those are kind of the main drivers of most of the songs. Organ, floor tom, bowed fuzz bass, tapes, shortwave radio, drums, wandering genie, which is, I think, is a type of keyboard or organ, a singing saw, bowed, banjo, accordion, white noise, trumpet, trombone, flugelhorn, euphonium, home organ, air organ, fuzz bass, one-note piano, zanzithophone, which is my favorite sounding instrument.
What's a one-note piano?
Just the name of it.
That sounds like a joke.
Just one-note piano.
Oh,
saxophone and Eulian pipes.
I got to stop you there because there is one footnote in the 33 and a third volume by Kim Cooper that I'll be quoting from regularly. There's only one footnote in the entire book, and it's on the zanzithophone.
Oh, I'm so happy you said that because I did extensive research into the zanzithophone.
Yeah. Do you know why Laura went through three zanzithophones during the recording of In the Aeroplane Over the Sea?
Because it kept melting under the heat of her hot skills.
You're close enough. So zanzithophone, I just can't say it.
It looks like a toy.
Yeah. Kim Cooper calls it the Susian named zanzithophone.
Yes.
Which I liked. That's good writing. So it's an electric sax.
It looks kind of like what's the thing that people used to play? The keyboard or the key. It looks kind of like a keytar.
Yeah.
Mixed with an ocarina from Ocarina of Time. Not a real ocarina because I don't know what that is. But it looks kind of like a cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like a children's toy.
Yes.
But it was a professional instrument as well. And it was very, very poorly designed in that the people who created it did not realize that when you blow into a horn, you have this thing called spit in your mouth. And then inside the instrument, there's these things called electronics. And the two don't mix really well. And so that's why she went through three of them in the recording of the album.
Gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this, you mentioned that this album was the first thing you knew about it was that it was kind of a big love letter to Anne Frank. Anne Frank, of course, famous for writing the Diary of Anne Frank. She died in the Holocaust. She was hiding in the Netherlands with her family. They were found, they were somehow given up to the Nazis, and she went to Bergen-Belsen and passed away. But before that, she obviously wrote her diary, Diary of Anne Frank, and there's a lot of lyrics in the album that are pulled directly from the Diary of Anne Frank. And the lead singer, main songwriter, Jeff Mangum, said that he read the whole book in 2 days and spent 3 days crying. That's kind of like his quote around that and the influence it had on his kind of philosophy of life and music and just mindset towards this album.
Yeah. And from what I've heard, Jeff wasn't a big reader. And so it was also, it was like connecting with a book for the first time too. So it was all of it in one, this incredible, it was not just loving Anne Frank, but like his first love.
Right. Right.
I mean, it really odd, especially at that age. He was young, but he was in his 20s, you know? So it's kind of a strange event for his life. And he's an odd and unique guy. But the more I read about him, the more he's just one of the most earnest and genuine people that I've ever, you know, read about.
Yeah, the album does have a sense of honesty throughout. And I was going to say intention, but we'll get into kind of whether it's intention or accident, a lot of the things that we love about this album or appreciate about this album.
Well, yeah, that's a great place to – one quick thing there is obviously the most obvious reference to Anne Frank is Holland in 1945.
Yes. Yeah.
And Anne Frank died in Bergen-Belsen in 1945. She was not in Holland in 1945. She left Holland in 44. So even the most direct reference there, the most obvious thing, is just wrong when we're talking about intentionality. But often, as we'll discover as we go into some of these lyrics, he kind of discovers things that are really interesting despite the fact that he doesn't intend them.
Yeah, definitely. And going back to the kind of the concept of the album, it was Mike McGonigal of Pitchfork at the time called it, said that In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, which, by the way, we need like a cool nickname for that. In the Aeroplane Over the Sea.
I just call it Aeroplane.
Itayotes.
Itayotes?
Itayotes. Is a concept album you can listen to without even being aware it's a concept album.
Yeah.
Which is the coolest thing ever, I think. I love the idea of concept albums. And To Pimp a Butterfly was like this when I talked to Brent last month, where it's a concept album. It's one artistic endeavor that has one theme throughout the whole thing, even though every song is doing different things along the way. But when I think of concept album, and I think McGonagall is kind of pointing to this, I think of like a random Rush album about aliens, or I think of like Spinal Tap about like the
Stonehenge.
Oh, about Stonehenge, right? Or it's like some weird, goofy concept that's like, we're going to do a song, 12 whole songs about this one thing that's really nerdy, and actually makes like 11 solid songs about it that aren't like 11 things just, or one thing just repeated 11 times, but it's 11 distinct songs that all have one uniting motif within each one, which is, yeah, it's just fascinating. They're very well done in that idea alone.
Yep, absolutely. The way I thought about it, I spent some time thinking and writing about it, and here's what I came to. I said, Airplane is such a complete album that it feels like an almost physical space. It's a room, the room where I go to write in. I can smell it, feel it. I'm haunted by their creative energy. I feel them cheering me on, urging me to splatter my thoughts onto the monitor and then cut what I've got because it's not bold enough.
2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Bigger picture here, just with, I guess, timeline for Jeff Mangum. First album was basically Jeff and one other guy.
The first Neutral Milk Hotel album, but not the first Jeff Mangum album. He was involved in a lot of different bands. Yeah.
Yes, you're right. Sorry, it was On Avery Island. They had a couple EPs before them, but On Avery Island came out in 96. And then that kind of got them on the map. They did a couple national tours with that and then went to Denver to record, or went to Colorado to record Airplane in 97. I think it was like September 97 they finished the recording. It came out in 98. And that... they toured for a year after that came out, and then he kind of hung up his guitar and left. They were even asked by REM to open for them on a national tour, and he declined, and people couldn't get a hold of him for, I don't know if it was years, but a long time. He basically just, he had a nervous breakdown and shut himself in his house for weeks and weeks, months, and no one could get a hold of him for a while, and he basically just kind of shut out the world. Did you, were anything in the 33 and a third about that?
Oh, yeah. It definitely gets into that.
Okay.
And I want to build up the REM thing even bigger because it was, you know, Neutral Milk Hotel came together in Athens, Georgia, which was about an hour from where I was doing the dissertation work in Clemson, South Carolina. Athens is a cool town. I'd head down there every once in a while and buy records and stuff. But REM is from Athens, and it is the town that REM built in terms of the cool indie music scene. REM's graphic designer designed the cover for Aeroplane. You know, there's a lot of connections there. And so REM asking them to open, asking Neutral Milk Hotel to open for them is kind of the brass ring, right? It's kind of, you know, and then you this is it. How they became big. And someday everybody would say, no way, man, Aeroplane was their best album. But they had a lot of other commercials, you know, and we can envision the entire story from there.
Yeah.
And so to just turn it down at that moment, not when everybody hated each other, not when, you know, they'd run out of things to say. In fact, he went and played some new music shortly afterwards, back in Athens, went home, did an acoustic show, played some new music at it. And people were like, whoa, this is heavy. They're going in a totally new direction. And the way that Kim Cooper talks about it is like, yeah, and that new direction, which was very dark, really wasn't Neutral Milk Hotel's direction. You can't imagine them just jumping around on stage, crashing into things, having fun the way that they did to this new dark emo version of themselves.
Yeah.
So that's kind of – I've come to kind of respect Jeff for that decision. I know it's involved in a nervous breakdown, which is tough, but it was – just kind of trying to figure out what to do with fame and fame seeming like it was right in front of him and realizing I don't want something else to define my value. I'm going to define my value. So whether or not, you know, Aeroplane ever takes off and becomes this huge cult hit, which it has, didn't matter to him. It was much more about like, no, I'm going to go do something else now.
So before we jump into the kind of the track by track, we'll go through every song. Did you want to give any more kind of setup to the history or making of or anything?
Yeah. Let me give you just a little bit more, and then I'll throw in little tidbits as I remember them as we talk through the different tracks.
Cool.
Jeff Mangum and Robert Snyder were best friends in grade school in Ruston, Louisiana, home of Louisiana Tech. Both of their fathers were professors there, if I remember right. And so they grew up together. They were really tight. They did a bunch of bands together throughout high school and middle school. And neither of them, so far as I can tell, ever really took much music lessons. They were not real trained. And when I say they had a bunch of bands, some of them were more like when you're in high school and you're like, oh, and then we could have a band called, and you just make something up.
Yeah.
And
We've both been in those bands.
Yeah, yeah. And you literally play one show.
I believe you were in a band called Cabbage, C-A-B-A-J. Oh, yeah.
J was for Jason. No, it was for Joe.
Yes.
I don't remember. I think I was out. I don't think I was even in Cabbage.
I don't remember.
They had a different name when I was in it. Oof.
Awesome. Awesome.
But yeah, they were in like literally dozens of those bands. And they would create their own liner art and everything and then dub them and pass them out to friends. So, I mean, very similar to, I think, your high school experience and the bands you were in.
Sure.
Although maybe not dissimilar from a lot of people's high school experience.
Any of the like... the nerdy musicians that aren't good enough to be in band.
Yeah. Yeah. So they ended up out in Athens, did some stuff, and then finally kind of got back together and recorded this album together called On Avery Island. And Robert's whole goal was just it's kind of On Avery Island is actually kind of a love letter to Jeff Mangum from Robert in a weird way. He just wanted Jeff to be able to create everything that he wanted and to get everything his way. And he was like, Jeff has this genius that I want other people to be able to see.
Was Schneider producing other albums or he was just...
Yeah, he was starting to, but he said that On Avery Island is really where he learned to produce.
Okay.
So like one of the big things, Jeff demanded, he hated electric guitars. He thought they all sounded the same.
Yeah.
And he demanded that his acoustic be a line in. Directly to the board.
Oh, dude.
Oh, I love it.
Nerdy question. Mic'd or pickup in the guitar?
I believe pickup.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. So that is speak for, I want the worst possible recording on my acoustic guitar. Yes. That's not going to sound good.
You listen to some On Avery Island.
Yeah. It's the roughest parts of Airplane are the On Avery Island parts, basically. Just kind of distorted guitars that should be, I mean, I say should, but like that should be clean, but they're just kind of distorted and fuzzy and lo-fi sounding.
That's the other thing. Jeff really liked fuzzy sound, but he didn't want to use any distortion. He didn't want to use any fuzz pedals or anything.
You sent me a quote from 33 and a third about the fuzz. It was this long, like page-long description of the fuzz from the producer, Robert Schneider. And it was fascinating.
Yeah.
It gets really technical. And the idea is basically, okay, if I kind of explain it without reading it right now, I just kind of absorbed it when I read it. But basically, like when you want to have that fuzzy sound, right, that like Jimi Hendrix, Smashing Pumpkins, big grungy fuzz that just like rattles your speakers, most people use a pedal, right? There's a fuzz face pedal, which is what Jimi Hendrix was famous for. There's a bunch of distortion pedals that have that fuzzy, really big low end sound. You can also literally any pedal crank up all the way and turn the high frequency down, and it's a fuzz pedal. So that's all fuzz is. But it's taking those smooth arcing, like parabolic audio frequencies that you see when you're just seeing audio waves, and it's increasing the audio level so much that the peaks and valleys are cut off and they're smashed, and they create squares rather than waves, and that creates that kind of like peaking, crunchy, overloaded fuzzy distortion that can be like, it can be harsh and irritating, or it can be like creamy and like a luscious fuzz sound. It's a very diverse type of sound, but it's also a sound that's very intentional.
Yeah.
So if you have like, sometimes if I turn my mic input all the way up, I'll have fuzz right now on my audio and that'll sound really, really, really bad. We don't want that. Right.
Yep.
And most vocals, you don't want that unless you're doing a very purposeful, like distorted, angsty sound. But as a producer, Schneider said that he put fuzz on literally everything and not ran it through a fuzz pedal, but he literally turned the input up and through the mic and the console, the engineering console, got that peaking distorted sound, which is like a big no-no basically in audio engineering world and in recording. And you want everything clean. You want to record it all clean and then you can kind of mess with it later. But he just insisted on getting everything right up to that red line, turning up the volume on everything. And I don't know if it was a philosophical thing as much as it was an experimental thing for him.
It was more Jeff's philosophical thing. And Robert talks about On Avery Island recording that he would do some stuff and he would get these great ideas and like get a perfect sound that he'd worked on. And then Jeff would listen and go, no, it still sounds a little bit too clean. And he'd have to like undo everything he'd done. and completely redo producing it from scratch.
Right,
and
right.
He likened it to one of those Tibetan mandala kind of paintings where the wind blows it away at the end. And you know that you're doing this just to do it. And he said that that's why that album is how he learned to produce, is because he had to do it so many times. He had to do everything just right. And so when they get to Aeroplane, at this point, Jeff is not as demanding. And Jeff is much more like, let's just do some stuff and let's find out. And so, yeah, some of that stuff was an experiment, I think, from Robert saying, you know, okay, I want to do the stuff that Jeff wanted earlier, but I want to find some new ways to do it, and I want to give myself some challenges. Robert does not get a lot of credit as one of the main voices of Neutral Milk Hotel.
Right.
However, he was the only other main personnel on Avery Island. Jeff did guitar, drums, vocals, et cetera, et cetera. Robert did organs, fuzz bass, xylophone, horn arrangements. And then there were Lisa did fuzz bass and Rick Benjamin did trombone. And he'll become important in a second. Then a few years pass and they decide to get a band together, to really make Neutral Milk Hotel a band. Because this was never...
Not just the Jeff Mangum project.
Right. That's all it was. Right, it was Mangum project. And they pick up a drummer that they had met previously when he was in high school, a couple of years ago when they were touring in another band. They pick him up in Chicago and bring him in. They get a bassist up in New York. They flop. They crash at his grandma's house for a while where they put together a lot of the music. They go down to Athens. They just start putting it all together. And they pick up the cool kid from town, Scott Spillane, who was the cool older kid who was in all the bands when they were in high school.
Yep.
They find him slinging dough in a pizza place down in Austin. And he can't talk because it's the 2 a.m. rush. And Jeff just sits there and goes, well, do you need some help? And he's like, yeah, man. And so then they just make pizzas for the next couple hours. And then they go out and have a cigarette. And then Jeff's like, man, this job kind of sucks. He's like, yeah. He's like, you want to join my band? He's like, yeah. And so that's how they got their fourth member.
Wow.
And
that's awesome.
Scott did all the horns, and Scott didn't play horns. And so Scott learned Rick Benjamin's horns. That's why Rick was important for this story, from on Avery Island, so that when they were playing stuff, he could play it. And so he went down in the basement, and he would just play it over and over and over again until he could get it. He also couldn't understand treble. He couldn't read treble on a music sheet.
Yeah.
He could only read the bass lines, and so he transposed everything into bass, onto the bass
line. Yikes.
I mean, like, this is how kind of unique everything was. Scott Spillane had never played horns. He learned to play horns for this. And I love the horn work on it. There's something really beautiful about it. And by the end of it, he didn't feel comfortable improvising on horns at all. He was not there. And so he would have to go downstairs and just practice for like days until he got his part right. And he'd go, okay, guys, I'm ready. And then he could play his horn part for it. So, that's a little background. So they all got together in Athens. The songs were starting to come together. I told you about this quote earlier, Ben. The way that Jeff actually wrote the lyrics. This is a quote from Kim Cooper's book. People marveled that he rarely seemed to write lyrics down, instead working out songs by singing them again and again until the words fell into a repeatable pattern. One of the few kinds of exceptions to that is actually in the Aeroplane Over the Sea, which came to him complete. He was lying on the lawn with a bunch of friends looking up at the sun and just went, oh, ran inside and played that song in its entirety.
Wow.
And they all listened to him play it.
So he's definitely like tortured genius level, like Kurt Cobain-ish. Yeah. Like, he's just on another level. And it's stuff like that that makes me realize it's not an accident.
Yeah.
Things that I'm like, oh, that's a cool thing. Or you go to genius.com and read all the lyrics and you kind of see the different meanings to different lines and you're like, oh, like that's an interesting inference, or there's three possible things this could mean. You're like, no, like Jeff probably thought of all three of those things when he wrote that line and sang that line.
He was really influenced by Dadaists and Concrete Music as well. And so he was trying to do weird, funky stuff and open the doors of perception with music. And I think one of the other things about Neutral Milk Hotel is they all had their own kind of side projects, and they've all kind of gone on and done other things since then.
And he's played with a bunch of those different bands since then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Never as the main person, I don't think.
Right. And he's been on a few recordings and things.
Yeah.
Playing on different songs. But Neutral Milk Hotel really is In the Aeroplane Over the Sea. That's when we're talking about it, it's that album.
Yeah.
And In the Aeroplane Over the Sea was a moment. It was, you know, five or six different lives that just happened to intersect at the right moment where that could come from it. And a second album would not have, there was no arc. There was no single arc that they could have all gone on together. It would have pulled them into its orbit and become something else. So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing.
We talked about this a couple days ago, and I think when I finished the album for the first time, just kind of sitting down, got my, like, best headphones on and just, like, sat down in a quiet room and listened to it. And at the end, I was like, wait, so, like, what's next?
Yeah.
Like, I want to hear the third album and the fourth album and the ninth album.
Yeah.
And with Weezer, like, you get the Blue Album, you get Pinkerton, it's all building, and then you get the Green Album.
Yep.
And then you get, like, all these albums that kind of go different ways, and whether you like it or hate it or whatever, like, at least you get to see where that band went. And this is just, like, that's it. That's all you get.
Yep.
Enjoy Aeroplane for the next 20 years.
And you can.
Yeah.
I can. I'll sell them so much.
Yeah. That's all we get. So far, at least. You start diving in?
Yeah, let's do this.
All right, so first two songs, The King of Carrot Flowers, part one.
Sure.
And then the second song is part two and three. So let's talk about part one real quick. It starts off with just kind of folky guitar, like acoustic guitar, and his kind of nasally, whiny, I don't know if that's too negative of a term, voice.
I think it's accurate.
They do a good job of the entire album making it sound stripped away and stripped down throughout. Like at least half the songs, maybe probably more than that, have a part of the song at least that's just vocals and guitar.
Yeah.
But listening to that, dissecting that, you can hear that there's actually two to four guitars at the same time and separate vocals in each ear and different harmonies throughout. So it's very well produced, even though it sounds stripped down, which is kind of like the dream of folk and acoustic stuff. I mean, it's sounding simple, but very hard to accomplish. And it's the lyrics are basically sinking into the Diary of Anne Frank. It's like the introduction to that concept, basically.
Yeah,
I was going to say something I noticed in reading it was that it's 12 lines, the whole song. It's like 2 minutes long, 12 lines of lyrics. And the first three and the last three are about conflict and violence. And the middle six are about discovery, imagination, and love, kind of curiosity. So it starts with violence, goes into like love and curiosity, and ends again with kind of that turmoil again.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. And there's a lot of things like that in this album that it's just, you can tell this wasn't just him sitting down and writing for 10 minutes and singing it. There's hours and hours and hours and lots of thought went into all the lyrics.
And you haven't even gotten into the themes of cannibalism and incest.
Not yet. No. Although your mom would stick a fork right into daddy's shoulder.
Yeah.
And dad would throw garbage all across the floor. I mean, there's some lyrics that are pretty straightforward.
Well, I mean, that's it right there. Like you've got the incest and the cannibalism right there. Mom would stick a fork right into daddy's shoulder. That seems like just kind of an abusive childhood situation.
Right.
But he's been called the King of Carrot Flowers. And you're wondering, wait, are these carrot people? You know, is this one carrot eating another carrot?
Interesting.
Also the references to your mom and dad. We could throw that out, except that that's a reference throughout.
Oh, true.
Dad is always referred to just as dad or daddy. And it's always your mom. And maybe it's just metrically that worked out, but it also then sets this up. Your mom would stick a fork right into daddy's shoulder. Dad would throw the garbage all across the floor as we would lay and learn what each other's bodies were for.
Mm-hmm.
Evocative.
I mean, he also talks about, and this is the room one afternoon, I knew I could love you. He's talking about the room that, I mean, again, a lot of these have multiple meanings, but as I read that, it's the room that Anne Frank was in.
Yeah.
And there's another song that talks about Anne discovering her body and sexually and kind of becoming a woman. And she was, by the way, we should probably bring up at some point that she was 15 when she died.
Yeah.
So there is a weirdness, to say the least, an inappropriateness, whatever that is, of having a romantic relationship with her, right?
Right.
Of Jeff having a romantic relationship with her. And
on the flip side, she should be 70.
Right. And also the idea that she's been dead for 50 years and there is no sexual relationship.
Yeah. And she writes about her budding sexuality. in the
diary. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was like 15 when I read that. It's been
I remember
time.
Not being allowed to read those parts. Our teacher was like, oh, skip this part. We got to skip this section. I was like, it's the interesting stuff. It's the stuff that connects with us. We're going through this too.
Yeah, right.
it's not super graphic. Just like looking in the mirror and being like, hey, I got boobs. That's weird. I'm pretty sure that's a direct quote.
Yeah. Is it that or it's Tina Belcher?
I can't remember. It's one of the two.
See, they're Anne Frank.
Often
Tina
confused.
Belcher.
Yeah.
Yeah. And musically, this is basically a guitar, vocals, and there's like a slight accordion throughout or in between the verses.
Yep.
And so it's kind of introducing you to like, hey, this is a rock album, but it's a little different.
Yeah.
Get ready.
And you get that vibe right from the cover. Where it looks like something from the 1920s. It feels like the circus is coming to town, and the music immediately sounds like the circus is here.
Yes.
This is a lost rock record from 1920, which makes no sense.
Yeah, it's those things that make me realize, like, oh, they didn't just EQ it poorly or record it. They didn't just, like, record it in a basement with, like, really bad mics. They did this in a way that was very intentional, right? Like the cover isn't just like a random picture they found.
Yep.
It is, right? In the sense that like it is literally a postcard that they found, but they also manipulated it in whatever it was in 1997, photoshopped it or manipulated it in a way that mimicked that retro style with the drum for the head.
Dude,
that wasn't there in the original version, you know?
You would love this book about it because he goes through the entire process and how he pulled that paper stock quality from the postcard onto different objects so that they would have it as well. And even on the CD, this is missing on the LP, which is what I have, but on the CD, on the inside, you see the back of the postcard. So it just has some numbers on it. And it was just the numbers that happened to be on the back of the postcard. You just scanned them.
That's cool. Track 2, The King of Carrot Flowers, parts 2 and 3. Yeah. Any idea to the parts?
No.
1, 2, and 3?
I've got no idea.
Cool.
I love it. I
don't understand
so much.
It either. I don't get it.
I really think it's trying to alert you to the idea that this album is going to be kind of a complete piece. And all of these songs are connected.
Yes.
And doing that parts 2 and 3 kind of thing. I think in some ways it's being fake pretentious, like making fun of themselves a little bit, but also just connecting to, you know, we're actually going to have Two-Headed Boy will be next, and then Two-Headed Boy Part 2 will be the last song in the album.
Right.
All these songs are connected. You know, you need to get that in you real quick.
And this one starts out with...
Read it. I love you, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, I love you. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to those lyrics when you first heard them?
So the first time I had it on in the background, and we'll get to this... Well, we can get to it now, I guess, but the idea that there's this irritating thing about his voice. It's whiny.
Yep.
And it's not quite like Chris Carrabba, like screamo-y, right? But it's still like, it's less melodical than that. It's like there's sometimes where it's literally just whining, and then you get like some zanzithophone in there too that's whiny as well, and it's kind of they overlap, and you're not sure which is which. And it keeps me from, which is, we need to talk about this, because you talked about Aeroplane being a room for you to write in and create new things you didn't know were within you. To me, having it on the background on a loop is more irritating than comforting or enjoyable. But I either have to be all in paying attention to this album and like have it with the lyrics or like have it with like my eyes closed or not at all. Because if it's there in the background, I'm trying to have a conversation with someone. All I hear is, I love you, Jesus. It's just like crazy, right?
There's no way I could have a conversation with someone. Yeah, there's no way I could have a conversation with someone while this is going on. But the next time you have to write something, you got to sit down and write a few hundred words.
Okay.
I challenge you, you'll put this on and see what happens, especially if it's got to be something you're excited about, you're passionate about.
I think I might have to listen to another like 30 times before I can get to that, because even now I'm just like, wait, oh, I didn't hear that line that way the first time. I've only listened to it 4 or 5 times at this point.
This process may have ruined that for me, because now I'm actually paying attention to it.
Oh, well... My bad.
If I never write another thing, that's on you.
So track 2, it starts building, right? The whole album is building. Again, it starts with the I love you, Jesus Christ. I love you. Yes, I do. Gets into a lot of the, a lot more allusions to Anne Frank. Again, as I think 10 of the, or 9 of the 11 songs, and the other two don't just because they're instrumental, basically.
Yep.
But yeah, it ends. I think this is my favorite, like, 30-second clip on the album, and it's the last or towards the end where it's like that crazy punk, really fast drums, distorted guitars, which I guess is all acoustic guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And it just says guitars. And the distortion, again, because doing it from the console and not from a pedal, it sounds like it's broken.
Yeah.
Right? And he talks about, like, it sounds, because you're actually pushing the console and pushing the line in, it sounds like this organic, like, over-enveloping, broken tubes, broken diodes, just like it's not working right. It should not be working like this. And if you're doing the fuzz face pedal, it's going to sound like, oh, it's cool, like distortion. But this is like this, it's much more, I guess, emotive than like the smooth, creamy distortion from like Weezer or Pearl Jam, that kind of stuff. It's not just that like grunge, metal-y Nirvana distortion from the mid-90s, but it's this like broken sounding, like you, I've honestly thought my speakers had like blown a fuse or like, or the woofer was broke, something was broken. Because it's just like overwhelmingly distorted.
Yeah, you listened to the auto-tune Smells Like Teen Spirit, right?
Yes, terrifying.
Yeah.
To a major key.
But yeah, by the end of it, you kind of like it. And you're like, this sounds like early 2000s pop punk. This sounds like Good Charlotte. Like,
right.
Wow. It's, I did not realize that.
True.
In the Aeroplane Over the Sea is Smells Like Teen Spirit, but they went the other direction.
Right. How can we make this sound less appealing?
Yeah. can we get grungier and whinier?
Yeah.
We're really selling this album. I think we're doing it.
It's just, it's fascinating because there are things that I don't like, but I still appreciate.
Yeah.
And I think that might be my kind of catchphrase for the whole album.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know if I would listen to this every day the rest of my life, but I'll definitely, I don't think there's ever a point in my life where I will stop coming back to it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Because I'll keep finding new things to appreciate.
So what did you think about that line, I love you, Jesus Christ? Because I've read now a lot of people responding to it, and they had a very different response than I did. So I kind of want to know what your initial response was to it.
Definitely confusion. I mean, the first thing I went to was, this is a song about a Jewish teenager, and he's talking about Jesus Christ.
Right. What did you think he was trying to convey through it, if anything?
One of two things. One, a kind of, I don't know if this is the right term, but Unitarian view of like, all religion is good. The religion doesn't matter as much as the fact that you're seeking higher power and trying to do good. And he's picking Jesus Christ as his symbol of religion or greater power, you know, him wanting to praise something.
Right.
And then the other one is probably not true, but like, yes, I'm doing this song about a Jewish family, a Jewish young lady. But like, God, I still, or Jesus Christ, I still love you.
Right.
Which there's no other Christian imagery within the album that stood out to me. So I don't think it's that one. But that was my initial one of like, is he apologizing for being a part of this Jewish? And he does have also allusions to other Jewish traditions as well throughout the album too.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if this is some sort of like kind of apology. Yeah, exactly. What about you? What's the right?
Well, there's no, the only right thing to know is that he meant it very authentically. He meant, I love you, Jesus Christ.
Okay, so it's not done ironically.
No. And my initial thought was that it was ironic. I assumed, based on the rest of this album, not knowing anything about Anne Frank or anything like that at the time, I just kind of assumed that this was a sacrilegious, a blasphemous way of saying it.
Yes,
like he was making fun of people who love Jesus.
Right.
Then I thought it was more romantic. I love you. Jesus Christ, I love you.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I didn't thought about it like that way. Yeah.
And I found out later that it was actually a turnoff for a lot of people who are atheists listening to the album. They'd be like, ugh, and then he gets into the Jesus Christ stuff. And then there's the issue of, how is this part two of King of Carrot Flowers? And the answer is, in a sense, it wasn't. I listened to a live performance by him, and there was no set list, by the way, for his live performance.
Of course.
It was in Athens, and it was before recording Aeroplane, but it's a lot of the songs from Aeroplane. And he's playing it. Somebody just yells out, he says, what should I play next? He goes, Jesus Christ! He goes, that song really doesn't go anywhere, though. All right. I love you, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, I love you. Yes, I do. And then he stops. So evidently that was a thing that it shows he would do, like, between songs. Like, it was just those lines twice. That was the entire song.
And there's no, like, was brought up in a Christian family, his dad was a pastor, or, like, that we know of, right? There's no, like, fell away from the church, or, like, there's not a lot of, like, Christian influences that are at least publicly known.
Yep.
Aside from the intro to this song.
Yeah, and just growing up in the South. And I think that's a large part of it, is just a feeling of spirituality. And I think in that moment, he's just expressing a sense of worship and wonder at the world.
Right.
We'll talk, I think, in the next song, or actually, next song is where we'll talk about what the album as a whole means, because I think, in a sense, it's the key to it.
Yeah, and I'll just say that through the first three songs, going into the, we can transition to the third song now, no chorus.
Yeah.
There's no chorus that these verses are leading to.
Yep.
So there's just a couple verses on each song, and a lot of crazy music going on. There's a trumpet solo with these, like, exploring drums throughout the second track. And it just ends in this crazy broken sounding guitars and trumpets and synthesizers or whatever other instruments are layered on top of each other. And then, we get to the title track, track number three, In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, which is kind of the lyrics kind of lead the listener through how Jeff and Anne are kindred spirits.
Yeah.
Right. Through how it's his joy of kind of discovering his soulmate is how I read it. And kind of that combined with the tragedy that they'll never be together until it's the last verse where they'll never be together until they're dead. And I think the line is, oh, what a beautiful face I have found in this place that is circling around the sun. And when we meet on a cloud, I'll be laughing out loud. I'll be laughing with everyone I see. Can't believe how strange it is to be anything at all. So it's a very existential crisis for Jeff is kind of how I read the song. What about you?
I think he's playing with scale here in an interesting way. So he's giving you the key to the album, which is Anne Frank, right? We'll hear about her in two songs. We'll get much closer to that in Holland 1945. And that's the What a Beautiful Place. Or What a Beautiful Face.
What a Beautiful Face, yeah.
And then the I Have Found in This Place is the other scale. So not focusing in, but going broader. What place is he talking about? He's talking about life, existence as a whole. That's circling all around the sun. And that, to me, is why In the Aeroplane Over the Sea is the name of the album. And it's why this song is so interesting, because the entire thing is ruminations on death and love.
Yeah.
And I'd say it's the other kind of thing that it resonated most closely with for me is a book called Life Against Death by Norman O. Brown that was written in the 50s. And it's a psychoanalytic reading of history, where he's talking about the death drive that drives us all to kill, to destroy, even to destroy ourselves through drugs and whatever. And he's talking about the antidote to that is this kind of life, the erotic impulse, which can be funneled into poetry, into music, all kinds of other things. But it never wins. You know, death is going to win in the end.
Right.
And so what do you do to that? You can, you know, go in your room and cry about it, or you can go try and make something beautiful. And so for Norman O. Brown, and I think for Jeff Mangum, that sense of eros and life and love and sex and all that, it can be sex, which is why there's a lot of references to semen on this album. But it's also, you know, going and pushing your kids on the swing, right? It's that's part of the same impulse for them, this big, gigantic, overflowing pile of love.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be distinguished in that way. And that's the antidote that Jeff also gives us. And so the image of the aeroplane is given in the next verse, or the next, I don't know, stanza, whatever they are.
In verse 2, yeah.
And one day we will die, and our ashes will fly from the aeroplane over the sea.
And one day we will die, and our ashes will fly from the aeroplane over the sea. But for now we are young, let us lay in the sun and count every beautiful thing we can see.
And I get the impression that we are, the aeroplane over the sea is existence, you know. There's a journey being had. We're on it. We didn't start the journey. We were kind of born on this airplane. And one day, they're going to throw our ashes off of it. We just get to be here for a little of the ride. We don't get to see either coast, right, where we took off or where we land. We just get to be here for a bit of it. And then the next bit, but for now we are young, let us lay in the sun and count every beautiful thing we can see, which is really his prescription for us as you get into these existential crises.
And he talks about ashes a lot, I think at least three different times in the album. And when I say a lot and it's three times, the album's only 39 minutes long. So it's 11 songs, but it's pretty quick. It's a quick album. And there's, it's very dense lyrically.
Yeah.
And he talks about ashes a few times. He talks about, I think, gray, we'll get it later, but gray or white clouds spiraling up from the ground. And
yep.
That's another kind of allusion to what I think is an allusion to the Holocaust and to the concentration camps.
Yep.
And yeah, there's just a lot of double and triple meanings to all of these lines that are fascinating to just dive into and kind of, to just kind of think about what could he have been meaning. Cause even there's a lot of times there's not even an obvious meaning.
Yeah.
But it's like even the genius.com or before I even read like what they think it might mean, it was just kind of like, well, this could mean this or this.
Yeah.
And then it would give me like three possible other meanings that it could mean.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's all either rhyming or fitting within a meter or just sounding poetic and nice at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do all those things at the same time.
Yeah. It's such a, the album is in tension with itself.
Yeah.
And it keeps
it. It insists upon itself.
It insists upon itself. it's like a guitar string, right? That's tightened. It's these two contrasting things. And it's between that contrast as you tighten the string that you get that perfect harmony in between. I'm stealing that image from Heraclitus, of course. Sorry, guys. I'm a nerd.
Of course.
So yeah, back to Anne Frank. We get another key in here. Anna's ghost all around. Hear her voice as it's rolling and ringing through me. This idea that he's possessed by her, but also a reference to the later song Ghost on the album. Again, uniting everything. And then the next verse starts with, now how I remember you, how I'd push my fingers through your mouth to make those muscles move that made your voice so smooth and sweet. And here he seems to be literally imagining taking Anne Frank's body and using it as a puppet. And that's, I find it, you know, disturbing and all those things, but it's so interesting when he contrasts those two. Anna's ghost all around, hear her voice as it's rolling and ringing through me. That's the beautiful way of putting it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now let me put the crass way of putting it.
Right, right.
Is all that I've really done, you know, dug your body up and tried to make the mouth move? Because that's not beautiful. And in between, you get the soft and sweet, how the notes all bend and reach above the trees, which I think is kind of the message of the song, and goes right before the musical saw takes off with the melody and just kind of wanders there for a while in this beautiful way.
And another way I read it, which isn't necessarily mutually exclusive to what you said, but the idea of pushing my fingers through your mouth to make those muscles move, the way that Anne Frank is speaking to us now is through the pages of the books that she wrote, through her journals. And he's literally pushing his fingers through her mouth in the sense that he's pushing the pages to make her mouth speak those words that she wrote down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she never spoke those words. She just wrote them down.
Yep.
So again, two meanings that I think both are different, but both work together. Which is, again, the more that's what this album is.
Yeah.
Lots of theories that don't necessarily mean that the other one is wrong.
So, yeah, as long as we're being trying to understand what the world's going on, this one's probably not going to solve it for us. We will take off our clothes and they'll be black.
Our first song with a chorus, Two-Headed Boy.
Yeah.
Starts off angry guitar strumming, kind of screamo type yelling throughout. And it's specifically the parts that I understood, at least, were about the death of Anne Frank. It talks about kind of starts off with the Nazis searching for her. And I am listening to hear where you are, as I think in the first verse, to doing experiments on her is kind of what I understood it as. And her family, as well as the other people in Bergen-Belsen, the other Jews in Bergen-Belsen. And then ultimately to finding her peace and purpose in death.
Yeah, I just, that initial image, and we can get to the Anne Frank level of meaning, but just the surface level image of a two-headed boy in a jar in a dark room. And then he says, I can hear as you tap on your glass, I'm listening to hear where you are. He's searching a dark room for someone in a jar.
It's
tapping
dark
on the glass. I mean, that's so dark. And again, maybe it's like you said at the last one, that's an image for the book. Trying to find that book. You just look in a library and it's as though you can almost hear it there somewhere in the back. There's that book that you have to read that's going to make it all work. And you're searching through that dark room for that book. And he found it finally in Anne Frank's diary. And then the other one kind of lyric that jumps out to me is, we will take off our clothes and they'll be placing fingers through the notches in your spine, which every time I heard it before paying attention to the lyrics, I thought was romantic. I thought the image was sex and
right.
running your fingers down someone else's spine, putting your fingers right between the notches of their spine. And it was this romantic thing. And then I noticed when I was looking at the lyrics that it's no longer we. Now it's they'll
yeah.
place. And it's not an image of sex. It's an image of people walking into a concentration camp. And
but what are two bodies, spines, right?
Huh?
What are the two types of spines we talk about? Just like you just
oh,
said.
Oh, and the book. Good call. Oh, right? Wow.
Mind placing blown. Fingers through the notches in your spine.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Freaking Jeff Mangum.
And when all is breaking, everything that you could keep inside.
Yeah. That's a book, dude.
Dude, that's my game. Everything is meta. Everything is just about itself. You outplay the master.
yeah. And there's a line in this I think is my favorite line. And some of it is what I read about and some of it is my own inference. But the last line, two-headed boy, there's no reason to grieve. The world that you need is wrapped in gold, silver sleeves left beneath Christmas trees in the snow. And it, I think because it reminds me of like poetry that I would try to write.
Mm-hmm.
And like poetry, like I think of like a line and be like, yeah, I have this awesome line and not be able to actually like write a poem about it. But it's the idea that there's like a meaning within a meaning within a meaning. The line left beneath Christmas trees in the snow is the idea that, going back again to Anne Frank, but the idea that a Christmas tree isn't a Christmas tree when it's in the snow.
Yeah.
You have to kill a Christmas tree for it to truly find meaning and purpose in life.
Mm.
You have to get it out of the snow. You have to kill it. And then it's a Christmas tree. And in this sense, it's like Anne Frank, where if she wasn't alive in the 30s and 40s, I don't want to say her life wouldn't have meaning, but obviously it has impacted millions and millions of people since then. The fact that she wrote this book down and the meaning and purpose of her death has been able to inspire and touch that many lives because it happened. Yeah. As much as we wished it hadn't happened, that the positive outcome of that happening has been overwhelming. And that wouldn't have happened if she hadn't have died.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many just mind-blowing lines like that.
And then to connect back to the ideas you were pulling on Judaism and Christianity, we've got mm-hmm. the Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the end of the song with the cantor-inspired singing.
Which is the dee-dee-doo-doo-dee-dee.
Which I didn't notice before I looked at some commentary of people, lots of people responding that, you know, this is clearly inspired by Jewish cantors. And he was very, you know, you asked me about some of the influences on this album, and he did not listen to a lot of contemporary music. But one thing he did do was he listened to a lot of ethnographic recordings. So Eastern European music, you know, Roma music, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so some of that is coming out there, and I think some of it probably is inspired by Jewish cantors.
Well, yeah. I mean, how could it not be? Because that happens three or four different times. And specifically, it's the D sound.
Yeah.
Either it's a sound starting with the letter D.
Yeah.
D, do, da. A lot of times through the album, and it's almost always that D sound that is in the Jewish cantors. Is that what they're called?
Gosh, I think so. I hope that's the right thing. That just means singer in Latin.
Yeah.
I know cantor is a position. I know it was some kind of Jewish song that is inspiring it. So I'm not certain that it's the one the cantor sings, but possibly.
Yeah. And then next we have the first of two instrumental tracks, not in a row, but it's called The Fool, the fifth track. And
the one song not written by Jeff Mangum.
Yeah, this is Spillane. Jeff Spillane? Scott Spillane. And it's a 3-4 signature with kind of a slow trumpet ensemble. It's continued from the last song musically at the end of Two-Headed Boy, so it's kind of a similar style, even though it changes the meter. But it has a similar kind of military marching sound to it as well. And especially the horns add to that, right? We have taps, we have other things. But the trumpet adds that kind of military kind of imperial sound to it. And I've heard one of the meanings is that the reason it's called The Fool is due to the, it may imply at least, that it's the foolishness of militarism, especially in light of the Diary of Anne Frank.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot more sense. And there might be other meanings as well, but it's hard to take meanings from an instrumental track.
Wait, it was originally recorded for as a score for a short film. That's what he wrote the song.
Oh, wow.
Okay. A friend's short film called The Fool. And in the film, there's a grandma who keeps reminding her grandchild, who's more foolish, the fool or the fool who follows him. And if we let that kind of have a say in it and connect it back to what you were saying about militarism, it's stop putting all the blame on Hitler. Not going to say he's a great guy, but millions of people followed him.
Right.
The real lesson is to be careful and never to let this happen again. Not by avoiding being Hitler, because you're not going to get that opportunity. But if that's right. your scale, that's going to be a low bar to avoid.
Right.
And instead avoid, you know, empowering someone like that.
Yeah. So the, not the title track, but probably the single, if there was a single off this album.
Yep.
Yeah. It's track six, Holland, 1945.
I love this song. And when I learned that the whole thing was about Anne Frank, this is the one I went, oh, duh. I didn't connect all the other pieces, but this one just immediately came to mind. It was originally one of my favorite songs on the album. It probably still is. Lots of really cool, there's a whole cosmology here. And there's a few cosmologies in this album. The airplane going from one coast to another, being existence, and us being tossed off in between. Here we've got ideas of reincarnation. The only girl I've ever loved was born with roses in her eyes, but then they buried her alive one evening in 1945 with just her sister at her side. Only weeks before the guns all came and rained onto everyone. Now she's a little boy in Spain playing pianos filled with flames. On empty rings around the sun, I'll sing to say my dream has come. The empty rings around the sun being the Earth's orbit, you know, the years that have passed. The little boy in Spain being Anne Frank reincarnated and having a nice idea of this reincarnation. And in verse 2, we ride the circus wheel with your dark brother wrapped in white. So we're continuing around the sun. Says it was good to be alive, but now he rides a comet's flame and won't be coming back again. And so this dark brother has decided not to be reincarnated.
Mm.
It's nice while it lasted. I'm going to get out, which could be dismissive of us. It could also be a literal idea of nirvana, stepping out of the wheel of samsara and escaping all of this thing. The rings around the sun turned into empty rings around your heart. The world just screams and falls apart. And I want to let you respond, but at the end, I do have to read verse 3 in its entirety and see if I can do it without crying because it hits me hard.
Yeah.
So verse 3 is probably the most explicit Anne Frank and also the one that doesn't connect because I believe Anne Frank did not have brothers. She had a sister.
But it could also be like brothers as in family. Just, comrades. Yeah, exactly.
Friends, family. It can be lots of interpretations. It opens that up. And it also has the idea.
Well, and also I did read here that just before you read this line, one of the band members had a brother who committed suicide.
There's a lot of connections to that throughout the album.
Yeah. So that's why sometimes it's he instead of she, and I think the indentions in the sheets is reference to that. And anyway, sorry.
Yes, so no, that, you're absolutely right. And then lastly, there's a reference in the last line to White Roses, and the White Roses were an anti-Nazi group Germany.
Yes.
And Kim Cooper confirmed that Jeff Mangum had never heard of them. So that's another interesting connection that he happened across. It's a great image for this if he meant it, but he didn't.
That's crazy.
But because he's doing all this cool Dada stuff, it really doesn't matter that he didn't mean it.
Yeah.
This is kind of his moment to let the universe sing through him. And it's like, well, this is what I wanted to say, so get over it.
Yep.
All right. And here's where your mother sleeps. Here's the room where your brothers were born. Indentions in the sheets where their bodies once moved but don't move anymore. And it's so sad to see the world agree that they'd rather see their faces fill with flies. All when I'd want to keep white roses in their eyes. And I really can't sing without tearing up a little, read it without tearing up a little bit. I handed it to Megan as I was kind of preparing my wife for this. I said, here, just sit down, read these lyrics. And I told her, you know, it's about Anne Frank. And she read them, and by the end of it, she was just sobbing. I mean, it's a heavy song, and yet it is also weirdly radio-friendly and beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Track 7, Communist Daughter.
Yeah.
This one's a little more straightforward.
And if we're keeping track, on the LP, This is all side one. We have not gotten to side two yet. So Communist Daughter is the last song on side one. All right, so Communist Daughter is straightforward. Tell me about that.
So it actually is not talking about a communist daughter. Other than that, it's pretty straightforward, I guess. Semen Stains the Mountaintops, I think, is pretty straightforward. It could be talking about snow on the mountains. It could be talking about
pearl necklaces.
Semen on, yes, on breasts. It could be talking about a lot of things. There's other lines that talk about she moves herself about her fists. So the idea of Anne Frank and her discovering her body, kind of like we talked about before, becoming a woman.
Yep.
Probably masturbating is what these lyrics are referring to throughout.
Yep.
And it's interesting how the music, the instrumental parts reflect that as well, reflect masturbating or just sex in general, how the intro is kind of messed up. Like he stops and he starts again, kind of like the entrance to Good Riddance at Green Day.
Yep.
And the guitars have kind of random noises circulating left to right stereo throughout. And it ends with like this crazy static and radio kind of feedback. So it's just like messy, not beautiful. I shouldn't say not beautiful, but not perfect song with still these beautiful imagery within. What did you say? What, you don't think it's straightforward?
No, I think that's right. I think that's totally right.
All right.
The weird thing is it's such a mournful song.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel sexy. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
For whatever it's worth. Every corner, cars screaming from the crowd. The bridges burst, then twist around. And wanting something warm and moving dance towards herself. The soothing proves that she must still exist. She moves herself about her face. O'Cumley.
So another, it goes from Communist Daughter, which is this like expressive song that has kind of a morose tone to it, to this 3-4 O'Cumley acoustic guitar led and even more sexualized than Communist Daughter. It's just kind of every line is about sex, it seems like.
Yeah. And this is an interesting one because the version on the album, it was done all in one take. It was the first take, and he was actually sitting down just to do like a sound check, get the levels right, and he played the whole thing all the way through, 8-minute song, boom.
That's insane, man.
And another interesting thing is if you listen to the live album, Live at Jittery Joe's, you can hear the very first time he played it live. So you've got two kind of firsts for it, in a way. You know, the very first time he played it, and then the recording on the first try. So it's a really unique and interesting
That's
song
cool.
that way.
And ends with, like you said, this is done in the first take, and it ends with, if you turn it up at the very end, a band member from the other side of the studio just screaming, "Holy shit."
Yeah.
And the top of his lungs.
They think it was Scott Spillane who did that.
I love that.
Basically, everybody, when he was doing it, everybody gathered into the control room. And it wasn't going to be a big deal because it was just going to be a second while he checked the levels before everybody else came in.
Yeah.
And then as it started to happen, it was like watching a perfect game or something, where everybody just gets completely silent and watches this happen.
Right. 8.5 minutes.
Then who I'm assuming is Scott just lets out, "Holy shit."
That's crazy. So Ghost might be the most kind of one-off. This is track 9, Ghost, in the sense that it's not completely about Anne Frank. It seems like every other song is. And this is about literally a ghost who lives in Jeff's house that he used to sing to because he didn't know what else to do to the being haunted.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Jeff's mental state. Jeff had night terrors and would have waking nightmares or nightmares where he'd walk around and stuff. And the people in the house kind of learned to be able to actually talk him down while he stayed asleep and never wake him up. But I can't imagine what that's like for any of these parties involved. He would sometimes, practice his songs in the bathroom. Because of the acoustics. And so he kind of got to know this ghost like while he was there that he felt was in the house still.
This is an interesting mix musically of acoustic guitar intro with like big distorted guitar and bass kind of hovering in the background, layered under an acoustic guitar, which is a kind of a rare sound in general to have acoustic with the fuzz as two separate things.
ghost, ghost, I know you live within me. Feel as you fly.
And then, yeah, one of the, I think in the first verse, he talks about how I know that she will live forever. She will never die. She won't ever die. Which is talking about the ghost, but also talking about Anne, again, referencing her writing, that she will live forever because she was able to get this diary out, write this down before she died. So,
yep.
Yeah, other references to Anne in this song are the fact that she said she, and she goes, and she knows she'll never be afraid. And that's a reference to Anne Frank. The direct quote from Anne Frank from her diary is, I've reached a point where I hardly care whether I live or die. The world will keep turning without me, and I can't do anything to change events anyway. I'll just let matters take their course and concentrate on studying and hope that everything will be all right in the end. And I think from that paragraph alone, there's so many lyrics in this album just taken from that right there.
Yep.
The idea of the world turning, you're talking about the cosmology in, I think in Holland, 1940, or was it the Communist Daughter?
Yeah, Aeroplane was the biggest one about cosmology, but also Holland, 1945.
Yeah, the idea of the world keep turning. I think Holland 84, a bunch of the cosmology within the album, the fact that she would mention that too, and yeah, that it kind of ends with this, all of the instruments I read before kind of piled on top of each other, and it's just like this, lots of zenzithophone, lots of just crazy strings and horns piled on top of each other, and that big fuzzy bass and guitar kind of echoing throughout the song too.
And she gets to live forever through her work.
Yeah,
weirdly, so does Jeff.
Yeah, good point.
I don't think he was thinking of that.
No.
At the time. I don't think any of them thought this would be big and influential at all. They thought it would be, they thought it was important.
Yeah.
They thought it was exciting, and they thought it was unlike anything they'd ever done. But I don't think they thought it would connect with people like it did.
Yeah. That's an interesting idea. The fact that it is, I didn't thought about that, but this song is the ninth out of, I mean, there's two more songs on the album. So this is the ninth out of 11 tracks. And this is kind of the culmination of all of the story of Anne Frank within this album. Next, we have an untitled track, and then it ends with Two Headed Boy Part 2, which is kind of a reference to the entire album combined, right? We'll get there. So let's do Untitled next. And I think this is my favorite song on the album.
I was going to say my favorite moment is the build from Ghost into Untitled.
Oh, and that's another thing we need to mention is that most of these songs connect as one big song, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, Untitled seamlessly blends with the previous song and the next song. Lots of zenzithophone in a really cool way. But yeah, and it's just a really cool melody that sticks in my head for days and days. This is probably the melody that sticks in my head the most. This, the intro, 1945, and then Two-Headed Boy, that line, are the ones that kind of stick in my head randomly in the middle of the night or whatever I'll think of. So yeah, 2 minute song Untitled, then it goes to the last track, Two-Headed Boy Part 2, which I think the whole song is just kind of a 4-4 straight beat, only acoustic guitar and vocals, and kind of strips away a lot of the stuff musically that's been going on, and lyrically references every single song on the album.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of summarizes the album, lots of just kind of references to it himself, right? I don't think there's a lot of new stuff in this other than the fact that it's entwining all of these previous things together.
Yeah. It's the table of contents or the callback to everything.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that ends with the last line, but don't hate her when she gets up to leave. And then you hear him, if you keep playing it, stand up, set his guitar down, and walk out of the recording studio. Again, intertwining his life and the idea that we have of his impact and his influence onto Anne's, right? The idea that we don't know them anymore, but the art that they did at the time is how we best know them. That's how they live on.
Yeah. But don't hate her when she gets up to leave.
I was playing this. I've been playing this around the house all weekend as I just prepared for this recording. I was listening to it with my daughter, and she was getting into it, and she was dancing around. She loved the twirling and stuff. And then when he puts down his guitar, she stared at me like, what was that? Like, it was amazing. She reacted to it. Like, she stopped and was like,
wow.
What? What that? You hear that? And I was like, yeah, do you know what that was? Yeah, what? And I'm like, well, the singer took his guitar and he put it down and he left. And you know what? He stopped playing music after this. This was his last song, and he decided that he didn't want to play music anymore. Why? And she's, you know, 3 years old almost.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think he just made something really beautiful, and he was so excited that he made this beautiful thing. He didn't want to do anything else because he thought, well, this is it. I made something beautiful. I know. And she runs over, turns on the keyboard we have in the other room, and plays like 8 notes, just kind of at random, then turns it off and comes back just grinning.
Like she did the same thing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
She played something beautiful, and it's done now. She turned it off. And I was like, oh, that's great. And I turned on the piano, and she goes, no, and then turns it right back off. Like, no, I'm done with it now.
It's done.
Yeah.
You should have heard it the first time, because it's done now.
Boom. It's done.
That's awesome. Sweet. So any other notes on Jeff or this album or Neutral Milk Hotel as a whole?
We've
talked for a long time.
We talked a bit. I do have a quote that I wanted to end on, which really brings together that idea of trying to encourage others to make art. I'm totally stealing from Kim Cooper because she ends the book with this quote with no more commentary, but it stands alone and it's really good. He's talking about the group Elephant Six, the music collective that he had in Athens. Mm-hmm. He says,
this is Jeff.
This is Jeff talking. Yeah. I think what Elephant Six meant for us is very simple. There's something pure and infinite in you that wants to come out of you and can come out of no other person on the planet. That's what you've got to share. And that's as real and important as the fact that you're alive. We were able at a really young age to somehow protect each other so we could feel that. The world at large, careerism, money, magazines, your parents, the people at the rock club in your town, other kids, nothing is going to give you that message necessarily. In fact, most things are going to lead you away from it, sadly, because humanity is really confused at the moment. But you wouldn't exist if the universe didn't need you. And any time I encounter something beautiful that came out of a human somewhere, that's them. That's their soul. That's just pure, whatever its physicality is. If the person can play piano, if they can't play piano, if they're tone deaf, whatever it is, if it's pure, it hits you like a sledgehammer. It fills up your own soul. It makes you want to cry. It makes you glad to be alive. It lets you come out of you. That's what we need. We desperately need you. So I love that quote because it's a call for more creation. And so the last thing I wanted to play is something actually not by Neutral Milk Hotel, but a song by Girl Talk that samples Neutral Milk Hotel and then does interesting things to it. So this is the song Minute by Minute off of Night Ripper from Illegal Art is the name of the production company. And don't worry about quoting Girl Talk. I think he's cool with it.
Thanks again for listening to Best Album Ever, and thanks again to Jason for joining me. I had a great time listening to that album and diving in with him. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast network, and if you're feeling generous, go ahead and rate and review us on iTunes. That would really help us out in a big way and help us create more content to share with you as well. So, as always, you can check out our website at overthinkpod.com. Our handle is at overthinkpod pretty much everywhere else. So, give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram and even like us on Facebook. That helps us out spreading the word. So, we're always interested in hearing from listeners. So, please drop us a line and let us know what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, maybe some albums you want to suggest yourself, our email address is overthinkpod@gmail.com. Thanks for stopping by.